everyone. Welcome to this week's Bounty episode of the Day Zero podcast. I'm Spectre, with me is Z. In today's show, we have some auth bypasses, a macOS libxpc bug, and an Android vuln that was reported by Meta. But we'll start off with a relatively straightforward auth bypass in OpenEdge, which is an app development and deployment suite that's present in the admin server service. So this was patch-diffed and analyzed by Horizon 3. They go into a little bit of their detail on reversing the admin server applet, which is Java-based, but the vulnerability here is very straightforward, and it's the fact that when they looked at the authorize user functionality, they noticed that in the vulnerable version, if you simply pass an account name of NT Authority System, it authenticates you. So it's just sort of like a very easy backdoor sort of functionality, potentially there from like debugging or like development code. And well, once you're authenticated, they point out that, sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say, or the actual case of that service trying to interact with the software, like something running under that, where it's not going to have credentials. It's not going to be able to actually run through there, because the purpose of the functionality here is that it's you. So the admin server by default will use just local auth. It'll use the accounts on the local server. And it's like, you know, they can't really do that with this particular account because it's not really something meant to be used by a local user. But then when it tries to authenticate for whatever reason, I'm not sure if the use case here, but that was my guess when I read this, was just they're actually expecting that sort of interaction to happen. Although not knowing how the software is used, I don't actually know their use case or why they'd have like the service interacting with them. But I imagine they may just install like the actual service that's going, or some service that's running a system that it's going to interact with. So that was my thinking there, that it was kind of that sort of functionality where they didn't have a better, well, there are much, like even token auth would be better than just, yeah, allow it in based on the username. But they're possibly not really thinking about being able to control the username when they're writing this sort of local auth thing. Like somebody who's writing that, I assume this is used more than just with this particular login system. And so if it's used in the sense of just on the local system, like what user is currently running sort of deal, you don't necessarily have the same thought that this is going to be an attackable thing where somebody's actually going to be controlling that username, but then they use it in with this sort of login system. So that's where I feel like this probably came up, rather than just being like a backdoor, just kind of not think about all the ways it could be used or inappropriately using this because it's not actually a local user.
So I do want to call out, actually, and it seems like this kind of indicates that the authors of the post kind of agree with you. In the indicators of compromise section, they state that while it seems that accessing the service via the NT Authority service account was intended, we did not observe log entries associated to this account outside of service startup, because that's what they ultimately use for their IOC, is that NT Authority system string being logged for the authentication log entry. So yeah, they state that they think it might have been intended to, so, you know, fair enough. On my initial reading of it, I thought it might have been a backdoor thing, but yeah, maybe I'm wrong on that. Maybe it is more of an intended functionality that they just didn't consider all the implications of. But ultimately, it does resolve in a fairly easy auth bypass. They do mention some vectors that could be used for getting code execution, such as like Java deserialization or built-in functionality. Again, it's one of these things where once you're authenticated, getting code execution is not really a leap. It's kind of expected that you're a privileged user at this point. So they've mentioned that there's probably ways that could be escalated to code execution fairly easily from here, but they didn't explore it too much in the interest of time. But I did want to call that out as they do.
Yeah.
Starting out with a really simple issue.
It's a simple issue. The one thing I kind of want to call out from this one is just the idea of how application suites are doing that service authentication, because that is somewhere that things can go very wrong with. This is a pretty extreme situation, but you know, it's always worth looking into that sort of service auth rather than purely the user. I mean, this side we are kind of looking at from the user side, but it is trying to authenticate the service that shouldn't have real credentials. So if you're ever like on that case of actually, you know, an engagement with an application suite, there is often this sort of communication going on where something does want to, you know, authenticate with another service, and how that's happening is something that's definitely worth looking into, because it is in my opinion, kind of an overlooked aspect. But maybe it's not, and I'm just, you know, biased.
All right, so up next we have a libxpc bug in macOS that was supported by Mickey Jin, and it involves the ever reemerging issues with symbolic links. So it was a fairly significant bug that could allow privilege escalation to root, as the xpc role account daemon runs as root with privileged entitlements, such as the ability to access the role account daemon staging system integrity protected directory or SIP protected directory.
Yeah, I mean, the whole purpose of this role account thing, well, not necessarily the whole thing, but primary purpose is that it's going to move things into the system integrity protection directories and then execute them as root or as a privilege process. Like, that is its job.
Yeah, and part of the reason it's so privileged is because XPC is one of the inter-process communication frameworks that macOS has, and that's why it's privileged the way it is. And what the issue comes down to is when you try to communicate with an XPC service, the one they call out here is like Xcode Select, the account daemon will copy the XPC bundle into a SIP protected directory and launch it with root permissions, as he said. And if that XPC service bundle is from the system or it's already loaded, it'll just kind of already like just load it from the cache location. But if not, it'll copy it to a temporary location, being a UUID directory in the XPC role account daemon staging directory, which is considered trusted. And after that, it'll check the signature and the entitlements. And if it succeeds, it'll move on to the final execution location and then launch it as root. This all seems pretty reasonable until you factor in symbolic links, because by changing the XPC bundle file to a symbolic link before the account daemon goes to copy the file to the temporary location and symlinking it to the original Apple signed bundle, they can allow the signature verification to proceed on the original bundle. That'll succeed on the symbolically linked file rather than the file that they think is in a secure, unwritable location. And then the file contents can be changed post-validation for the launch. So sort of just subverting the signature checking by using symbolic links instead of the file contents. So the fix for that was fairly straightforward. They basically just reject passing symbolic links for the bundles in the account daemon, which makes sense. But yeah, like I said, it's just the ever re-emerging problem with symbolic links. And, you know, it's 2024 and it's still difficult to handle them properly.
Yeah,
in security contexts.
I kind of want to toss out there that this doesn't necessarily run things as root. It will, like, the purpose of this is so that you can set up a service to run as one of the role accounts, or roles that aren't intended for users to be, but some that a service can basically take on. And then how it does that is through the SIP protected folders, which are just folders that are a little bit more privileged and not intended to be modified. Like, not anybody can actually change it. So that's why they copy it in there and then do all their checking. That way it can't be, like, in theory, they shouldn't have to worry about, like, a time of check, time of use, because it can't be modified there. But it'll assume whatever role or run it as whatever role is actually in the, info plist file that's defined there.
So that, for the, yeah.
Yeah, so it could be root, and that would be the useful case here. Could be something else. I just want to kind of expand on what's going on here, because it is a bit of a weird thing for, especially if you're kind of more on the Windows side, for something to be doing. Like, why is this going through this weird process? So I want to kind of clarify what this service is intended to do. Like, this, it is kind of doing its job, and the SIP protected directory is something you don't really have on Windows. They're more just privileged, like either this privilege or not protected as system integrity protection. So yeah, just a couple kind of differences there, but ultimately the vulnerability is just that support for symlinking.
Yeah, Apple's permission systems are a little bit weird. So from someone on the outside, yeah, it can be kind of weird. And where I said root, I was assuming their example with Xcode Select. That's why they went with that service. But yeah, it's a fair call out that it would be whatever is specified for the metadata for that service bundle. So
yeah, you're going to want to do this with a root service, and you can choose to do so. Like, there's no reason not to. It's just more kind of explaining more about what's going on, because that is kind of the not necessarily unique aspect to this bug, but there isn't a lot of information when it comes to doing like desktop and service exploits on macOS. There's a little bit out there, like there's a lot of disparate information, but you know, if you haven't dealt with it at all, as I feel like, you know, it's not a common target. You know, most people don't know about, like, know, like you kind of mentioned XBC is a common thing for doing the inter-process communication. Like there's a ton of, like I think when I was doing the prep stream, I kind of talked about XBC, and like you'll see some of those bugs that are almost like the window messaging in browsers, like the on message stuff where you have to validate the origin and then they'll have to like validate the caller. And you'll have like kind of similar bugs in terms of how you validate the origin and stuff. It's just kind of like this whole area of Apple that isn't well talked about. Not that I've documented it very well for you guys here, but I figured it was worth giving a bit more clarification.
Yeah, I agree. All right, so we've talked a bit about Apple and macOS, but we also have an Android topic. So this is out of Meta's security team, which reported the vuln in Android's package manager and the package installer service that can be abused from ADB. And I'll let Z get into it.
Yeah, and this one's kind of fun. Has a bit of an ask when it comes to accessing this, because we are working inside of ADB. Nonetheless, I can imagine there being bugs that, you know, maybe can either allow the shell access and get in there, or use, there are other ways you may be able to use this. But the main idea is that run as, which is intended to basically like you run your shell or whatever your shell code is, to run that kind of as another application or under like their context in a sense. I'm not going to get into how like all of the Android stuff works and all of like the permission systems with SE Linux and all of that fun stuff. But what it will end up doing is that it will parse the packages.list file and it will basically just look in there for certain attributes. There's actually an example here of what one of those package list lines would look like. Like an example one here where it has like, you know, default target SDK version. So it's like giving different pieces of information that's using folders, whatever, just all these different attributes that would be in there. And this is just like a line and so new line for apps, and every app will have spaces delimiting different tags in a sense inside of that file. So run as will basically parse packages list and it's going to get a variety of information like the UID, SE Linux context, the data directory, so that's going to be like the private directory for applications. And one of the things is that run as should not run for, or you shouldn't be able to use that to take over the context of a non-debuggable application. So generally that's going to be like you can write your own application on the system, put it there, leave it as debuggable and be able to use there. But because of this package list, it's going to get that information from there. And then there's some other sanity checks around like, you know, the UID it's assuming, like just assuming the file might be somewhat compromised, but still generally trusting it. Anyway, I'm going into all this background information. The actual issue is when using this PM install to install one of your packages, so package installer service, and then doing like an actual install, you give it that flag. It doesn't actually check if the name contains any special characters. So what ends up happening is while the packages.xml, it's going to write information into there also. They get escaped and all that's done properly. But when written into the packages list that it's reading for all of this, that run as reads for this information, it's not escaped. So you can actually, you know, put a space into your name, whatever special characters you want that still kind of work. But have the space there and start injecting your own metadata into there, basically say like, oh yeah, this is totally, this package I'm installing, yeah, definitely debuggable. Oh, and this data directory is over here, and you know, do whatever you want. So you can actually gain access to another application's data directory, which maybe isn't the most impactful vulnerability that you could imagine, but applications will store kind of their private information in there, and that can include some proprietary information. Before the stream, where I kind of talked about this, and I'd mentioned like a hiking application I've used where you're paying about the price of like a guidebook for like a digital guide where it includes, you know, the GPX for the route, the trail you'll be following, images of like all these different key points, along with having like GPS information for all that. So, like, a bunch of that information that's all proprietary. And then you would just be able to, you know, pull that information or would be kept in data so it can't be downloaded by the average user. And you'd be able to use this to get access to that information, which generally you couldn't. I mean, if you had a rooted phone, like, you would be able to do this. It's not like it's impossible to get this information, but this is kind of a way of accessing some of that information that you may be able to use kind of as a self-attack, like, on your own phone, but not data you're able to use. So, like, I do think there are some practical attacks with this. The requirement to be an ADB, though, does feel like a bit of an ask.
Yeah, and just to elaborate on that a bit for people who might not be aware, so ADB is the Android Debug Bridge. So for one thing, the phone has to have ADB enabled. You have to go into the developer settings, and even enabling the developer menu requires you to go through kind of a bit of a process. But bottom line is you have to have debugging enabled. And then on top of that, ADB also has like signing keys where it has to be, the device has to be authorized to communicate with ADB. So even if ADB is enabled, an attacker device shouldn't easily be able to pair with your phone to be able to pull off this attack. So like having ADB access like this is quite an ask, which is why I was talking with Z a bit about it before the show, is because, you know, the impact here is pretty limited. That said, I hadn't really considered the threat model of attacking the application data itself. Now, as Z said, on devices that you can root, like, that's maybe not as important, like, although applications do have like anti-root checks and stuff too, which this might be able to get around. So that's something worth mentioning too. So yeah, I mean, bottom line is the impact is fairly limited here. I'm not sure how feasible it would be to do this on like a victim device that isn't your own device, but it is still bypassing an intended functionality where like it violates the security guarantees of the application sandboxing, which explicitly tries to prevent debuggability. So it is still an issue, don't get me wrong, it's still a bug, but yeah, the impact is a little bit questionable on it.
Yeah, like, definitely still an impact there. I think it's a cool bug nonetheless, just, you know, this one route, a kind of unusual route of installing an application. Most people are, you know, just going to go through the UI for that, but going through here, you know, it's just not doing the right sanitization on before writing, and you get an issue. It's a fun little bug. Like, it's still a nice find, I think.
It's very interesting that it's sanitized going into the package's XML, but not the list file.
My guess would be,
kind of an indicator of lack of centralization there on the sanitization.
Well, my guess would be that, like, they're probably using an XML library for writing packages.xml, whereas being just line data.
Fair enough. Yeah, it's probably just at the parser level. Yeah.
Yeah, like, they're probably just using, like, you know, like the printf family of stuff to write those strings out or something. Like, they're not
a lot more naive. Yeah.
Yeah.
Fair enough. Yeah. So getting into our last topic here, we have a post on some crypto issues in a smart lock. And it's one of those smart locks that allows like guest access for like BNBs and stuff like that. So that's a bit of useful context to know with what their attacks are looking at with attacking like the user keys and such. But I'll let Z get into the details.
Yeah, and they've got quite a few bugs they kind of talk about in here, or several attacks. I'm not going to go through all of them here. This is also a two-parter. So they do have a lot of background information. Part one, part two is the actual vulnerabilities that they discovered in doing their research. First one here that I will talk about is just reusing a virtual key. Effectively, what they found was, so the way this is intended to be used, you know, it's a smart lock, so the owner of the lock can be like, okay, I'm going to allow this person to access, you know, the lock from this time to this time, and they kind of, that person will have to install the lock application on their own phone. And, you know, they can have the key shared and use the lock for, like, you know, hopefully just that specified period of time. And as you can tell, probably by me saying hopefully, it actually, you know, was a little bit more allowed, I guess, or a little bit more permissive than that. What ended up happening is basically, while the virtual key worked how you'd expect, it wouldn't let you just plainly use it on, like, after your allowed date, or if it was a single use, it wouldn't like you use them. But these were basically just client-side enforcements, because when you'd get that virtual key, you would have to receive the actual key used for communication. All communication to the lock would be these messages that were AES encrypted. So you would receive that AES key. And then, or to do some of the challenges, need to actually use the lock, you would have to do a challenge response, or you would get a challenge request, you'd give a challenge response. And in doing that, you also required knowing the unlock key. So you basically had all of the information needed, and you would just be able to modify the time. Like, you could modify locally your time frames and do the communication however you wanted. You'd basically just change the key and keep using it. So fundamentally, just client-side enforcement of all the security that actually mattered. So, yeah, silly issue there. I do go into a couple more here where I've just mentioned the challenge aspect, where part of the authentication system, for any sort of sensitive action, it would require a send a challenge request, which would just be a 16-bit number, and that would be combined with a shared static and shared kind of private or secret key. So you would combine those two numbers, and that's your response. So these are, the challenge request is a 16-bit integer, and it's combined with this unlock key, which is another 16-bit integer. They add them together or whatever. I believe they mentioned that in the first one, it's just summing them together. That almost feels, I guess it makes sense that they're doing adding. I don't see why you wouldn't XOR it, but that's besides.
Yeah, I'm not sure why you wouldn't use like a less expensive bit. Well, I mean, I'm saying that less expensive operation, like in reality, it probably doesn't really matter. But adding is a little bit weird because you can run into some problems, which I'll talk about a little bit later.
Yeah, it is just a little bit weird to go adding, but it seems like they are kind of ruling their own crypto protocol here in terms of everything they've done. So it's also not that surprising. Anyway, one of the things they kind of came across was just the fact that the lock itself would only allow one device to be connected to it at a time. So they could kind of spoof the lock. And so they would connect to the lock, and then they would kind of broadcast in a sense, or have their spoofed device be pretend to be the lock. And the phone, so somebody trying to communicate with the lock, if the lock is already connected to, they wouldn't be able to connect to the legitimate lock, but they would go ahead and connect to the fake or malicious lock, and so they can get some information that way. Namely, with the very first request coming in, that's going to be like a check admin request, or kind of, it'll be a check admin message going across. And there's nothing unique in any of the requests. Like, they don't have anything to prevent replayability. So you're just able to replay that stage and basically capture that packet and replay it every time.
Replay it's sort of similar to... Sorry, I was just going to say, it's sort of similar to when we were talking about the Flipper Zero topic some weeks ago. And you were mentioning about, like, roll jam, where you would, you know, capture the code and then jam the transmission from going through to the vehicle and then replay it yourself. You can kind of do that here, but you don't need to jam it because of that locking that's in place with only one device at a time. So I thought that was kind of neat that it's almost similar to that, but easier to pull off.
Yeah, I see the relation that you're getting at there. That said, you're still going to end up having one of these challenge requests coming in, and that is going to be encrypted. I should actually mention here, sorry. This first attack, you know, it requires that you actually be allowed in the lock at one point. Like, if it's an Airbnb, you can probably get that kind of easily. But, you know, if somebody's using this personally, you're not going to be able to get a virtual key very easily. So it is a bit of a high request or high, like, starting place. So they want to also find an attack that would not require them to actually be allowed in once first, or, like, have that key. So they started looking at, well, how can we brute force one of these challenge requests? And that's where they get into this man in the middle aspect, where they're kind of relaying steps of it. Unfortunately, what they end up finding was just that, yes, they could man in the middle it. There's like replayability here, but still with the challenge, if they don't have that unlock key, and also because it's encrypted, their only hope of really attacking this was to, they'll receive one of the challenge requests, or they'll receive a challenge request, and then via the man in the middle, they'll be able to capture a challenge response and then to access the device at some other time, because presumably this is when, you know, the victim's actually going to their home, you probably don't want to break into something that's locked while it's being used. So it's not going to be useful for much longer. But they could take this, the challenge response that was there, and try and replay it again. And as long as it was the same challenge request, they can replay it. But the challenge request is a 16-bit random number, so it's probably not going to be the same value. And that means they have to disconnect from the lock. The original lock only comes up with a new challenge request every, like, connection, I guess. Like, so because the phone, or because the fake lock would be holding that connection open, it's not going to generate a new one. And they can't really brute force it because they can't generate messages. Again, because of the AES encryption. Which kind of leads into another vulnerability they found. And they actually figured, in terms of doing that brute force, that in practice, such an attack would take several days. So not the most practical attack in the world when it comes to... Like, I do imagine this is being used to break into a home if you also have to wait several days for it to work. But yeah, so you've got that. They did come across another vulnerability that is actually kind of the most interesting one, I think, in this group. And that is when it's processing the incoming message, these are generally always going to be encrypted, but it needs to figure out, like, hey, how many blocks are there to actually decrypt as part of that decryption process? And what it does to do that is it will basically just shift the size or the length of the payload that was sent in to the right by 16, or, well, by 4. Four times, basically stripping, basically giving you the number of 16 byte chunks within it. Kind of a math shortcut, you know, using shifting for divide by twos repeated. Anyway, so they get that. And if the block is zero, if block count is zero, it just assumes, oh, there's nothing here. And it just returns without actually decrypting anything. But then other processing will go ahead and continue because, you know, why not? They do go into a little bit about how they have to format this so it also looks like it decrypted something, because they do want to get this non-zero return value, whereas the return value, if you just kind of trust on this block count equals zero and fall in on here, I'm kind of going to skip over that, but, you know, they go through it. But what they end up with fundamentally comes down to just kind of miscalculating the block size, or treating a block size of less than one full block as just zero, which I guess is kind of fair because it isn't encrypted. There isn't an actual block there, but not airing out because of that.
Yeah, so I mean, it's interesting because when you are using crypto in this way, especially like block-based instead of a stream-based, you run into these issues where it's like, what happens if you have incomplete blocks or you don't have a full block or whatever? And it can be really difficult to handle those kinds of issues gracefully. And that's what ultimately is the issue here, where they just continue to treat it as if it's there's nothing to decrypt. So yeah, it is understandable is what I'm trying to get at. When you have to deal with the nuances of block-based cryptography, it can be very difficult to handle any edge cases properly.
I mean, this is where padding's supposed to be used. Like, there is a solution generally, to this, that's well understood. That things and that, are and supposed that's why to be you shouldn't padded.
Roll your own crypto, I guess. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, things are supposed to be padded. So if you get this, this should simply end up being an error. And in fairness, they do have to do that little bit more work in order to have it continue and not have total decrypted be zero, or basically having a non-zero return value. Anyway, what this allows them to do is for small messages, they don't need to know the encryption key being used, which then leads into another issue that they found, which was just being able to downgrade the protocol being used. And that just comes down to the fact that the header of messages will indicate what protocol should be used. And it turns out that while the latest version, you know, uses AES as its encryption and does all of that, the earlier versions actually only used an XOR with a single byte repeating key, which technically is encryption, but they don't count it as encryption, which
It's a multiple byte pad, I guess.
Well,
it's like a one-time pad, but only using a single byte and repeating.
Yeah, like infinite use, I guess. I don't know. Either way, it's very easy to break that sort of crypto. I mean, even just plain XOR with any sort of repeating key is generally considered pretty easy to break. The one-time pad thing being secure is because the key being used is the same size as the message being encrypted. So there's no repetition. Yeah. As soon as you get the repetition,
it's a problem.
Yeah. Anyway, so XOR with a single byte key basically just makes, like, it has effectively no encryption being used. And so they could downgrade this, and that way they would be able to get some unencrypted information. I'm not sure what value they actually got out of this. So they talk about their attack here, where what they're able to do is they use this protocol downgrade. So you kind of have the initial message come through using this man-in-the-middle thing. You store the first message, just as kind of we talked about with that check admin thing. You're storing that message. You send a challenge request with some known value. They use the example of zero while downgrading the protocol, saying like, hey, we don't support that protocol. Let's use this low one. And then you'll receive the unencrypted, using air quotes there, challenge response from the app. And if the challenge request was zero, then the challenge response is just going to be the value of the unlock key. So they're able to disclose the value of the unlock key, or at the very least, they can recalculate based off of whatever value they did give as a challenge request. The thing is, their brute force here, when they get to stage two and actually doing the unlock, they supply the AES encrypted message that they captured initially. They'll get a challenge request, and then they want to respond using, or they want to respond with a challenge response. So they're going to use this kind of plain text processing attack, so they don't need to know the AES key. But they mention here, we know the value of the unlock key, and we simply guess the challenge value with a 1 in 65,000 chance. That's so the same like the as a brute force. Yeah. Like it, that's 16 bits. Your chance is the same with or without the unlock key. So I'm not sure what the value of that was. Go ahead.
So this is something that Z and I were talking about a little bit before the podcast, because it's sort of weird where the challenge response they state will be the unlock key plus some random value. So basically what we're getting at here is you can formulate this in equation as y equals x plus some known number. It's like you still have two unknowns, so you can't solve for the challenge value, which is what they point out here. So basically, like, knowing what value is being added doesn't really tell you anything. It doesn't seem to reduce the key space at all. Now, what I was hinting at earlier with the sum being used is why a sum is a little weird is, especially with a 16-bit integer, you run into this problem of like, okay, what happens if you have a calculation that overflows? What happens if you have some, and it's a random value, so it's fairly likely to happen. If you add that random value to the user key and it wraps around, like, is that considered a valid challenge value? Or are they making sure that it doesn't wrap? Because if it's not supposed to wrap, then actually knowing that user key would be useful, because you would be able to cut down like that much off of uint max for the potential random value. But if that's not the case, then it tells you nothing, because it's just going to wrap around and, you know, there's no clamping on the value. So they don't really say here. So I kind of, and given the fact that they say that it's still a 1 in 65,000 chance, I'm going to assume it's able to wrap. But it's that just on its own is makes me question why add is being used as an operation here, because you know, when you're dealing with an unsigned integer like that, it's just, it's weird. But yeah, so we're not totally clear on the impact there. Like Z said, it seems like you're not really gaining anything by knowing that unlock key. But yeah, I think the main thing that's important with this attack is the fact that the lock doesn't close the connection on a wrong challenge response. So their brute force is more feasible, but I don't think they're really cutting down their brute force search space at all.
Yeah, like, I don't know. It's just weird that they talk about how they're receiving this unlock key, and it does make me feel like I'm just missing something. And I will be honest, I didn't, I kind of scanned through part one of this. I did not go through all of it though, mostly because, you know, when I'm reading these, I'm focused on the vulnerabilities, and like, I don't plan to actually look at this device to need to follow everything about it, like all the background information. So there is a chance that I'm just missing something, but looking at any point where unlock keys talked about in that last one really only comes up with the fact that it's being added, which I'm going to show in here on stream now, like just adds a challenge value to the unlock key and returns the sum back. Like that's just what it's doing. And so it doesn't feel like it's actually useful, because in this case, they don't know what the challenge value was. It is an encrypted message that they've got. So yeah, it just feels a little bit weird, but still, like, the protocol downgrade is still kind of a fun attack in a lot of situations where you can get it because of things like this, where it's used or can end up using this weaker crypto. And so I still want to talk about it as something to think about in terms of attacks that you can pull off, because it's not always just about like getting that SQL injection or something, like finding that really direct vulnerability. Sometimes just these downgrades can be useful. I'm just not sure how it's getting used here. So yeah, that's kind of what I got out of this post for these first few issues. Client-side enforcement, fair enough. See that plenty. The plain text message processing, I think, is kind of a neat bug and a little bit weird how, you know, what's happening there. Just, you know, like I mentioned, that early return kind of, it's not even actually all that early, but that return kind of breaking things. So there are some interesting issues. The attacks here, though, are a little bit less interesting to me.
Yeah, and these crypto issues are a great demonstration of why, like I said earlier, like, you know, don't roll your own crypto, is because it feels like crypto is kind of thrown on as an afterthought here, which I guess is kind of supported by the fact that the earlier versions used a single byte exclusive OR. Like, it wasn't really built in to the design, really. It was just kind of thrown on top of it, and that's why these issues seem to be popping up. Because it's using encryption, and it almost seems like it's also using encryption as an integrity guarantee, which it shouldn't be, you know, because even if you didn't have the keys and you just captured the messages, you could still change the bytes that would be in place of the challenge response to be able to brute force this that way too. Like, in a sense, you don't even really need to be able to decrypt the messages or have the plain text messages. The replay attack is really the core of it.
You could change the bytes, but this is, because it's such a small message, this isn't one of those cases like with the CBC attack, cipher block chaining mode, where you can flip a few bits in order to flip them in the next block and kind of like set values like, that way. Like, yeah, fair you're going to have a garbage thing there. So I don't see brute forcing by changing the encrypted data as actually being useful here. That is something that can be used. Like I said, with that CBC sort of thing, like you can actually do that really strategically. And there are some attacks where you might be able to take advantage, like especially if they don't do any chaining at all. Like there is no operation mode and just going block by block. Well, I guess technically that is ECB.
That is what they're doing.
Yeah.
There, but yeah.
Do they call out that this is specifically ECB and not like there's no block method at all?
Kind of assuming that. But let me see if I can.
They mentioned processing the blocks and needing to know how many. So I assume they were still operating with one of the.
It's a little bit weird that I didn't really think of it, but it's kind of weird that they never. And I'm looking at part one, too. They don't call out what AES mode is actually being used here. Maybe it's hinted at in their disassembly or in their like reversed stuff here. Let me just take a quick look. Oh yeah, they just implement like the AES directly, like with the Xboxes. So it looks like it's just like ECB. I don't think they're doing any. No, so
we don't necessarily know. They do seem to. We were talking about padding earlier, and I do see them talking about padding length there. So yeah, I mean they just don't seem to be erring on the padding.
Yeah, they're just not checking that the message is aligned to a block count. So they might be doing the padding, but they're just not like. Enforcing that it's there, I guess.
Since I do see the iteration here where it is presumably going over the blocks, I see the padding check here. There might be something going on where it is applying like block by block, so seeing like the CBC or something. I don't feel like actually reading this in detail to figure out if it's doing that or not. Because, I mean, they have the S-box, but that doesn't really tell you that it's not applying anything from the prior block or not.
I don't know enough about AES to really be able to tell the mode just from this code. And they don't point it out in the blog post, unfortunately. So
yeah, I'd want to actually step through this and figure it out. But like maybe somebody who's more experienced on reading the AES reverse engineered would just be like, oh yeah, I don't see them doing this, therefore it's definitely, but I'm not.
It
that
definitely
good.
Could be obvious to some people, but not me.
Yeah. Like I do see the couple XORs with one being the AES key, but then also something else going on here. And using the S box, not AES on the last thing, but or not XOR on the last bit, but because of that, it does look like it may be doing something with the site, like with the blocks and doing some sort of thing there. I just can't tell you exactly what's going on here.
Yeah.
Anyway, like that whole discussion doesn't really matter. Like my point. Go ahead.
I mean, to circle back to what my point was just that the encryption doesn't provide integrity. Now, whether or not you could actually take advantage of, you know, flipping bits to do like targeting the response value, I'm not sure. But basically,
I don't think that's what I was getting at.
Yeah, like, it might not be feasible in this case. But just the fact that they're only using encryption here and relying on it for everything is just kind of a indicator of how naive the system is for, you know, verifying the integrity of the messages and such.
Yeah, I mean, it is absolutely a code smell. I mean, so much of this seems like a code smell. Like, yeah, this doesn't seem right, so I'm not surprised if there's even further issues in the crypto or some things we have seen here. But yeah, it's their problems. Don't roll your own crypto system. I'm sure the developers here aren't listening to our podcast, so they're not going to hear that. But for the rest of you, you know, when you see this sort of custom rolled crypto system, look for bugs. Like there are low hanging fruit when it comes to crypto bugs that you can absolutely find out there.
Yep, for sure. And we didn't really talk about them, and I'm not going to go into a bunch of detail, but there are some attacks they point out here that kind of nullify all the crypto bugs too. And that's the fact that the lock does have an exposed debug port on the board. And not only is it like on the board, it's also on the side of the board that would be reachable from like the back of the lock, like not towards the casing. And on top of that, they also had updates that they also didn't have any signing or anything on. So you could just update to custom firmware. Again, the chip that's exposed on the back of the door that would be easier to access is the main chip that's running the firmware that's, you know, critical for the locking. So with the physical access part of it, it seems pretty weak on that side too, so you might not even have to care about the crypto issues. But personally to us, the crypto issues were more interesting, and that's why we talked about them more. Those other issues are in the blog post though too, if they're interesting to you.
Yeah, who cares about the easy wins? I want the fun wins.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, so that's most of the topics we had for today. We do have a shout out on a post from Portswigger on using forum hijacking to bypass CSP. I'll let Z talk about that quickly and then we'll wrap it up.
Yeah, this is actually one of the, you know, I usually like Portswigger posts. I'm not as big of a fan of this one, mostly because they talk about forum hijacking and then they just talk about a bunch of other CSP bypasses. That said, I actually did want to call out forum hijacking because it is a relatively untalked about thing, although it's also not the most powerful primitive to have. And forum hijacking is basically just the idea if you have HTML injection but not XSS, and you get inside of a form tag, normally form is going to have its little action attribute, and that's going to say like when you do a submission, it goes to wherever that form action, you know, indicates that it should go to. But on buttons, and I believe on images, or on an image source, because you can also use clicking on an image as a submit button, and then it adds like the X, Y, and all that. But because those two things can act as submissions, you can also include a form action attribute in there, and that form action will actually override whatever the form tag's action value was. And so you can kind of hijack a form to post it somewhere you like. So it is a way of exfiltrating some information with user interaction. Could be a way, or is something to at least know when it comes to trying to escalate, you know, HTML injection. When it comes to trying to escalate some of these issues, especially with a tight content security, they may not protect the form action. It talks about how to kind of protect them here. And talks about a couple other things like malformed syntax and problems that are the problems that can arise there and all of that. But I did want to shout out the form hijacking is, you know, something to keep in mind, something to consider. It's not the most powerful thing, but especially on a bug bounty report, it very well might help you out.
Yeah, and this was actually something that was reported to them that affected like Portswigger's site as well as the InfoSec Mastodon. So there's a bit of a fun backstory there too. So yeah, something to be aware of, at least. But yeah, so with that said, that's all the topics that we have for this episode. So as always, thanks goes out to everyone who tuned in. You can find the previous episodes on YouTube, Spotify, and Apple Podcast. Feel free to join our Discord and the Twitter. Links to those are in the description. And we'll see you next week.